I'm not muted.
You told me what these are.
They're good. Ramona, are you ready? We've got 30 seconds here. But, huh? We're starting. Okay.
Anyway, he said, this is the speech volume in the back of the room. We can mess with it. We'd probably never know it. But the people in the back will start going like this. Okay. Yeah. This is the volume of those computers, you know, if somebody should have a music or something like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'll mute that because I don't really expect that.
This will be part of the presentation.
Okay. I'll have this read May 15th. Okay, I got 8:45. I'll call this meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission to order. Could we have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Gibson?
Here.
Commissioner Christie?
Commissioner Christie said she had to go park her car, so we'll start without her. She'll be here in just a minute.
Commissioner Melskow?
Here.
Commissioner Rapa?
Here.
Chairman Rose?
Here. All right, and I'll ask that we all please stand for a flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Now we move on to public comment. Public comment is the opportunity for the public to address the commission on matters that are not on the agenda. The agendas are available in the back of the room, that little wooden box. Also, there's some agendas and the staff report for today's meeting on that little step. Could you point to them there, Matt? Yeah. Somebody wants to know what we're talking about when we refer to page 3-15 or something, they can have their own copy of the staff report and look at that. Okay, speaker slips. If you wish to address the commission, we would ask that you'd fill out a speaker slip and hand it to somebody at either end, and it'll make their way towards me, and that way I'll make an attempt to pronounce your name correctly, and the secretary will end up having it spelled correctly in the public record. Having said all that, I see nothing on for a public comment. Anyone wish to address the commission? And there will be opportunity for public comment for each one of the items as we go through them, but that'll come later. Okay, seeing no one.
Communiques from the coastal zone, so there's nothing from that angle, and John likewise. So unless you have something you'd like to discuss with us that's not on the agenda, we can move on with the consent agenda.
And Ms. Rapa did bring up an interesting point. We've all been filling out our paperwork for our recent travel to the Planning Commissioners Conference. And it's on my list of things to do to make a trip report. And I had an enjoyable time. It was very informative. As a matter of fact, it's become useful for one item on our agenda here later today. At any rate, what she was talking to me about was the complexities of travel reimbursements and maybe a one-page handout on the general rules might be appropriate to hand out at that time. Ms. Rapa, would you like to?
I think that's fine. I think it's a bit confusing, so if we could just kind of go over something and just have it real clear between us and our secretary and whomever else, it would be extremely helpful.
That's an excellent point and one that we have become aware of, and we're working on it. So we hope to have a nice, succinct one-page cheat sheet for you so you know what you need to do, and it's very clear.
I just advise revising the title of that report from cheat sheet to reimbursement
guidelines.
I understand. It didn't mean it quite the way that it might have sounded.
Just trying to help.
Good point there.
Mr. Chairman, under planning, quote-unquote planning staff updates, if I may, just to let you know, Michael Goodwin from my office will be retiring at the end of this month. And you see him fairly often as my backup for serving as public works support for your commission. So I thought you'd like to know we'll be hopefully promoting somebody from within the staff to replace him, and so you'll see a new face as my backup. And you've been seeing some auditions for that position over the last
year. Last time we had another Mr. Marshall.
Yes, he's not related, but he has the right last name, so he's a strong candidate for the position.
I see, so we don't get confused. But
just try to help.
And our congratulations to Mr. Goodwin. Is he going to stay in the area? Or I'm killing time till Commissioner Christie.
Yeah, Bob, move on.
I'm killing time till Commissioner Christie gets her car parked here.
I think he has some thoughts about moving out of the area, but not really firmed up yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have one more thing since we seem to be still killing time. What Richard said about Mr. Goodwin also prompted me to remember that our esteemed Mr. Hand, John Hand, is retiring at the end of the month, and next Tuesday will be a resolution honoring him on the board's agenda. And I know that you've worked closely with Mr. Hand in the past on RMS issues, design issues, Oceano-specific plan, San Miguel's design plan, and other important planning documents. And he's very well liked and will be sorely missed.
Well, thank you for that information. Since you brought up the Board of Supervisors, there's been a couple of appeals of what we did lately. How have they turned out? Can we get a summary of that?
Tuesday, we had four appeals at the board, and let's see if I can do this by memory. But not all of them went to your, now that I think about it, I'm not sure that any of them went to your commission first, because...
we don't care about them, man.
It was all hearing officer and SRB. We do have Cambria Bicycle Outfitters' appeal of your denial of the third time extension coming to the board on December 20th. I'm trying to think of any other recent appeals of Planning Commission decisions that have come.
About the...
maybe John's memory can...
The Oak Glen tentative track?
Oh,
Oak Glen.
That's right. That's right. That was on Tuesday. You want to...
And how did that go?
The board... decided to approve that project with a mitigation fee that would pay for a traffic study and eventual construction of a secondary and emergency access. By the way, I'm John Nall, planning staff.
Yeah. And that was the $10,000 per lot thing?
That's correct.
To fund the study? Okay.
That's correct.
For secondary access.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, there, also the Craig project, the GPA change and...
The Craig project, the Craig General Plan Amendment, was approved by the Board of Supervisors 2 weeks ago, I believe. Mm-hmm. One other appeal that we have recently received was on your approval of the Guadalupe Conditional Use Permit, Coastal Development Permit, which...
This item is scheduled for quite a bit of time. I had a conversation with Mr. Nall yesterday. The 160 minutes might not take that long. So people who are planning on coming to later items should be driving to the Planning Commission hearing room right now. If they're not here already. Okay, could we introduce the first item, please?
Hearing to consider a request by Unical Corporation to approve the wetland restoration and mitigation plan as required by Condition 67 of the Coastal Development Permit / Development Permit D890558D. In the South County Coastal Planning Area, County File Number D890558D, John Nall, Project Manager.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I'm John Nall. I'm your Principal Environmental Specialist with the Department of Planning and Building. Once again, we're going to take a little bit different approach on the staff presentation for this first item this morning. What we're about to present to you is really a fulfillment of a condition of approval on the original Guadalupe. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me a minute. I'm noticing my video screen doesn't have anything on it, and I'm asking AGP Video, do they have... usually what they're broadcasting I have out in front of me.
There it is.
There. Ooh, now this is
that element is not happening today. When there's a PowerPoint presentation, you'll be able to see it on your monitors behind the dais, but just...
Okay, as long as you got your video, I'm happy.
We're good.
All right. I understand we had some changes to how all this things works here. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's quite all right, Mr. Chairman. I'll pick up where I left off. What we're really looking at today is fulfillment of an original condition of approval on the original development plan for the Guadalupe cleanup. This was the original development plan was appealed by the Coastal Commission after the Board of Supervisors approved it. And what the commission did, Coastal Commission did, was they put a condition on that original development plan that required your planning commission to consider this wetland restoration and mitigation plan. And the reason they did that was they wanted the ability to be able to appeal your decision if they weren't happy with the way the plan turned out. And so that's in general what we're doing here today. This is a rather unique project for your commission to be considering. As you're all aware, the cleanup out at the oil field is a very complex project. It's going to take a very long time, and as a result of the ongoing nature of this project and the fact that staff resources are limited, the county has agreements with Unocal whereby Unocal pays consultants that work for the county to act on behalf of staff. These consultants prepare the EIRs, they do the mitigation monitoring, they prepare supplements, addendums, and they have also worked on behalf of staff on this particular item that you're going to consider today. That said, I'll introduce the consultants because they're going to be making the presentation. We have Bill Henry with the Morrow Group. The Morrow Group's a local firm, and he is staff's daily point of contact at Guadalupe Cleanup. In a minute, I'm going to turn it over to Bill. John Pearson with MRS is here with us today. John is the EIR project manager, and he's going to follow Bill with a discussion of this wetland restoration and mitigation plan. John was, by the way, the original preparer of the original EIR that was prepared for the cleanup. We also have a number of agencies here today, but I'll let the consultants tell you who they are. With that, I'll turn the presentation over to Bill.
Before we got there, could you summarize the documents that we're looking at? We had a staff report, and it was kind of short, but we had some other things.
You have a staff report, yes, and what we sent to each commissioner and made available to the public was volume one of the Wetland Restoration and Mitigation Plan, and that's what all of you have. In addition to this, and I made it clear in the memo to you, there's also a binder 2 and 3.
And we have them here.
And we have extras over here for any of your commissioners that would like one and any of the audience that would like one. I've got a couple of boxes over here. So that's what we're working from today.
Thank you.
And at this point, Bill?
Thank you, John.
You.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Planning Commission, Bill Henry, Morrow Group. Before I get started on the presentation today, I want to note a correction relating to today's agenda for this item. The correction relates to the agenda stating that 8.74 acres of wetland habitat would be impacted and 28 acres would be restored. The correct numbers and the numbers shown in the staff report and the wetland restoration and mitigation plan are actually the corner of the county of San Luis Obispo within the larger Napomo Dunes complex. A small segment of the southwest portion of the project site extends into Santa Barbara County near the mouth of the Santa Maria River. All of the wetland restoration sites are located within the county of San Luis Obispo portion of the Guadalupe Field. A brief project timeline relating to the need for soil remediation and habitat restoration at the Guadalupe Field originates from the project site's production of oil and natural gas and the use of diluent to facilitate this production from 1946 to 1990. Diluent is a hydrocarbon product which acted as a thinner in the oil extraction process, leaked throughout the site, and contaminated both soil and groundwater. Crude oil also leaked throughout the site and mixed with sand, creating what's referred to as sump material, which is the other main source of contamination. In 1998, the county certified an EIR that evaluated the impacts of multiple cleanup, disposal, and restoration options, including impacts to wetlands and sensitive species. Excavation of contaminated soil and groundwater and treatment utilizing a land treatment unit was selected as the preferred remediation approach. Also in 1998, the Regional Water Quality Control Board issued Cleanup or Abatement Order 98-38, mandating similar remediation actions. Excavations at the project site began in 1999, and contaminated soil was stockpiled at the project site. Some of this soil was used for land treatment unit pilot studies, and permit applications were submitted to obtain final approval for land treatment unit, for use of a land treatment unit for treating the excavated material. The land treatment unit permit applications raised numerous questions and concerns, and in 2000, UNICAL and the Multi-Agency Coordination Committee, or MAC, agreed that it would be best if excavation of contaminated soil was halted while UNICAL investigated other treatment options. The main concern was that use of a land treatment unit could result in some level of intermediary toxicity that could be transferred to water in contact with the treated soil. Numerous other disposal options were explored, and the option of transferring non-hazardous hydrocarbon-impacted soil to the Santa Maria landfill was applied for by UNICAL in 2003. Because transfer of contaminated soil from the project site to the Santa Maria landfill was not evaluated in the 1998 EIR, the county required preparation of a supplemental EIR. The final supplemental EIR was completed in June of 2005, and the proposed non-hazardous hydrocarbon-impacted soil transfer project was brought before the Planning Commission in July of 2005. At that hearing, the Commission voted in favor of the project amendment and certified the final supplemental EIR. As John mentioned earlier, this decision has been appealed to the Board of Supervisors, and an appeal hearing will be held on February 7, 2006. Depending on the outcome of the appeal hearing, UNICAL plans to begin contaminated soil excavation and wetland restoration at the Guadalupe Field in 2006. Condition of approval F67, mentioned above, is one of approximately 100 conditions contained in UNICAL's 1998 coastal development permit. In summary, this condition specifies that prior to initiation of oil spill remediation, oil fill abandonment, or infrastructure removal activities, which could result in unavoidable impacts to wetlands, except such activities at sites M4 and L11, the County Planning Commission must approve a wetland restoration and mitigation plan developed by UNICAL in consultation with the Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, California Department of Fish and Game, the County Planning Department, and the Executive Director of the California Coastal Commission. The complete text of this condition can be found in your staff report and on pages 3 and 4 of the WRMP. At this point, I'd like to turn the presentation over to John Pearson.
Thank you, Bill. Mr. Chairman, members of the Planning Commission, my name is John Pearson, and I'm with MRS. I'm going to talk a little bit about the how this wetland restoration plan was put together. One of the requirements of condition F67 was that UNICAL develop a wetland restoration and mitigation plan in consultation with various agencies. There was a lot of discussion about how to do this consultation, and it was agreed between the agencies and UNICAL to form a restoration working group. And the group was formed with eight members of UNICAL, a lot of consultants, to assure that what was put together was going to be a document that could be supported by all of the agencies. The Restoration Working Group worked as a team in developing the Wetland Restoration and Mitigation Plan. There were over 20 meetings held. It took about 3 years to complete this plan. Example is the Volume 1 that you were all given is Version 5. They went through a lot of revisions with all the various agencies to come up with this final three-volume plan. It was a very interesting process. I think there were probably at times UNICAL wondered what they were getting into, trying to get all these groups to try to come to consensus. But in the end, it really was developed as a cooperative wetlands at a 4-to-1 ratio. So for every 1 acre that they disturb, they're required to replace 4. UNICAL will be restoring or creating 30.24 acres of wetlands at 12 sites as part of the restoration project. So they easily meet the 4-to-1 ratio. There is some additional acreage here. They went a little further than they needed to
because with all of these excavations, until you get out there and start actually digging, you're not exactly sure of how much you're going to be disturbing. These are best estimates we have based on all of the sampling that has been done to date, thousands of samples at these sites that have been taken. So there may, that number, 5.65, could increase. It could decrease depending on where the contamination is. But the plan right now is to restore 30.24 acres of wetlands. This figure here shows the locations of the 12 wetland sites that are going to be where the restoration is going to be. A lot of these are also where excavations will be occurring. The Wetland Restoration and Mitigation Plan is a document that's composed of three volumes. As John Nall said, there's the main volume, and then two volumes of appendices that include the 12 site-specific restoration plans and then a number of various appendices. The main plan provides a summary of the goals of what the mitigation plan is, a summary of the overall implementation plan, meaning how the wetland restorations will go forward, a summary of the maintenance and monitoring plan. UNICAL is required to monitor these wetlands for up to 10 years to assure that they meet the success criteria that are included in these wetland restoration plans. Includes a list of the wildlife, vegetation that will potentially be impacted by the various remediation activities, as well as the success criteria that were developed by the Restoration Working Group for both vegetation and wildlife. The site-specific restoration plans that are in the appendices include a detailed description of the project and the site for each of the site-specific areas, a summary of the proposed excavation that is going to occur at each of the sites, pre-excavation site characteristics, what's the topography, what's the current vegetation, what's the wildlife. This was all collected through pre-construction surveys. And then a detailed discussion of the proposed restoration activities at the site. It also includes site-specific restoration plans, which include detailed restoration contours, maps, detailed vegetation maps, detailed post-restoration wildlife, vegetation, and goals. We did, in putting out this document, the final version that was sent to you also went to a number of agencies, and two agencies have requested some additional minor changes to various appendices, nothing to the site-specific plans, nothing to the main document, but have asked for some small changes to some of the appendices in the Wetland Restoration and Mitigation Plan. California Coastal Commission had some, and California Department of Fish and Game. UNICAL has agreed to all of the requested changes. We did hand out a package that has the detailed listing of the changes that we're requesting, showing where sentences are changed and strikeouts occur and word additions. California Coastal Commission, their comments really were on one appendix, Appendix R, which is Sensitive Plant Salvage Program. And what they wanted here was to replace the language on page 7 of that appendix under final success criteria to require a 2-to-1 replanting ratio for sensitive plant species. And then the other thing they wanted under final success criteria is an acknowledgement of the Habitat Restoration and Revegetation Research Program. There is a condition on UNICAL that if there is significant impacts to sensitive plant species and there are not known well-developed restoration techniques, then they need to undertake research to try to improve the ability to replant and restore these species, sensitive plant species. They have been doing a lot of work for the last 4 or 5 years on La Graciosa thistle, but Coastal Commission wanted this added into the final success criteria to acknowledge that this could apply to some of the sensitive plant species that will be revegetated other than La Graciosa thistle. Department of Fish and Game had some comments on Appendix Q, which was the risk evaluation. Most of these comments were additions to add some language to clarify the working group. We had a separate working group that looked at restoration and toxicity issues for these restored wetlands, and they wanted some language put in that laid out who was a member of that. The other ones are really minor changes in terms of sentences and adding references to Appendix Q. Army Corps of Engineers has issued a letter which approves the wetland restoration and mitigation plan, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has basically, they are not required to approve the plan by their biological opinion, but they have accepted the plan and are deferring to the other resource agencies for official approval. That concludes our presentation. We'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for staff? Gene?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a couple. Mr. Pearson, I'm a little bit vague on how this project fits with the contaminated soil removal that will probably go to the Center Mill landfill. Does that have to be completed first before this starts, or can they overlap? And you might clarify that a little bit for me. And the second one is, in reading this restoration plan, I notice in the wetlands that you're hoping for certain things to happen. But on some of them you say, well, if they don't, we'll fall back to this position. I call it fall back, or we'll be satisfied with this. And I'm wondering, you don't explain it in here, I'm wondering what the factors are that might cause that to happen.
With regard to the first question, this plan needs to be approved by this planning commission prior to UNICAL being able to begin any excavations at the wetlands. The transportation of the material that is currently stockpiled and from future excavations from the site to the Santa Maria landfill can't occur, obviously, until that appeal is heard and it's approved. It is likely at this point that none of these excavations would begin until such time as that issue of the final disposition of the soil is resolved. It is possible that UNICAL could attempt and get permits to stockpile additional material at the site and begin excavations. But I think the most likely scenario is until that's approved, they will not start any future excavations. What will happen here is the soil that is excavated from these sites, these wetland sites that are going to be disturbing, is going to have to go to the landfill. Once those sites are cleaned up and the regional board and San Luis Obispo County and the other agencies have signed off that the sites are clean, then they will bring in clean material and begin to backfill those sites, contour them to create the wetlands that are laid out in this plan.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes.
There's the ball back.
The fallback contingency question, there are very detailed, as you can see in the plan, success criteria for both vegetation and wildlife. And the success criteria for vegetation are both site-specific as well as field-wide. And I think it's everybody's hope that these success criteria will be met over a 10-year period. They have basically 10 years within which to meet the success criteria. I think they have to go 2 years without any maintenance, meaning weeding and things like that, and then determine whether they've met the success criteria. If they don't, then the UNICAL can propose other options, and if they want to change some of these success criteria or want to look at other ways of trying to comply with the mitigation, then they need to come back to this planning commission in the future with such changes. That's really, at this point, what I would say would be the fallback position.
I think, too, you were wondering what some of the factors might be, Bill Henry Morrow Group, in requiring contingencies to be implemented. Severe drought would be one such condition, which could affect the level of the groundwater table, which wetlands rely on. So, for instance, if we did enter into a severe drought period, there may need to be adjustments made to create the proper hydrologic regime so that the wetlands can be restored.
So, in your opinion, it's the groundwater level that's probably the biggest unknown?
Yeah, and I would say in developing these wetlands, particularly some of the ones that where we want to have open water, we looked at UNICAL looked at years of groundwater data and how it fluctuated over time, and we used the years of data that they have and went below kind of the low level to try to assure that even in drought we would still have open water. I mean, there's a lot of detailed hydrological work that was done in coming up with the final designs for these wetlands. So we think we have, you know, tried to address the issue of drought, but I think that's probably the biggest issue that we face today is in terms of success is groundwater levels and
All right.
Nature of how wet that site is.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Anyone else?
I had just
Mr. Gibson.
Just a couple of questions here. First of all, I'm tremendously impressed in the content of Volume 1, and just having looked at Volumes 2 and 3 briefly this morning, I would compliment all who were involved, and the agency intercoordination just looks excellent on this. I learned a tremendous amount reading just Volume 1 about wetlands. One question, just following up on the open water infill, and I guess it has to do looking at your analysis of the different habitat types or plant assemblages, depending on...
All together. This is unique, and normally when you're restoring a wetland, it's one site. That's typically here. We're in a unique place where we're actually looking at creating a total of, 12, 9 being kind of restored because they've been damaged, but we're going to end up with a total of 12 and more wetland than we disturb. So what we did is, in developing the criteria, we not only had site-specific criteria, which deals with the types of plant communities that need to be at each individual site, but in order to maintain a diversity, we also had site-wide criteria that allowed us to say one site might be a little more narrowly focused, but we want to make sure that we have a good representation of all of the different assemblages, including open water, across the site.
And the goal is site by site that you have created something similar after remediation to what you found there before. I mean, I was reading there's extensive pre-excavation surveys of the site that seem to be playing into how that's supposed to look afterward.
Correct. The one thing I would say is there was a group decision that we're creating more open water than there was currently. I mean, obviously we're going 4-1. We're creating more. We are taking some upland coastal sage scrub, basically habitat, converting it to wetland. They are required to then restore any of that back other places in the site, put that coastal scrub back. But we are creating more open water, and the main reason for that is for the, for the red-legged frog, which is an endangered species, and we're trying to create good habitat that will allow that endangered species population to thrive at the site. And they require open water, so we, some people felt wetter is better when it comes to wetland. Yeah. Other people didn't feel that.
Right.
But
right.
I think in the all, we probably went a little wetter than where we were today.
Well, and that seemed to be a conscious decision that failure might, failure of a wetland is on the dry side.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So.
Ms. Christie?
I have a few questions as well. And I'd like to echo Commissioner Gibson's commendation to UNICAL and county staff and the state agencies and the consulting firm that participated in this. I just think this is a exemplary example of state and local government and private sector cooperation, and I just really appreciate all the work that went into it. The detail, for those of you who haven't had a chance to read at least Volume 1, the detail regarding the monitoring and the transplanting and propagating of these species, weed removal. It's just it's an extraordinary effort, and I think I can safely speak for all of us when I say while it's a lot of material to read through, it makes our job so much easier to have this level of excellence to work from. So really appreciate that, and I hope that the continued data collection and potential research that comes out of this site really is a significant contribution to our evolving education about wetland restoration. I do have a few specific questions, and they're keyed to Binder 1. On page 51, it talks about the requirement for the surveys to be conducted within a 24-month time frame of the disturbance, and some of those surveys are going to still need to be done. You may have already partially answered this question when you were responding to Commissioner Melskow, but if the surveys need to be done within 24 months of when the site activity begins and you're uncertain of what the final disposition of the appeal of the stockpiled material is, do you have any kind of is it just a moving target in terms of when you're going to begin those surveys, or have they begun, or where are we in that survey period?
I'll give a brief answer, and then if you really want more detail, I think Jenny Langford from UNICAL, one of their consultants who kind of does a lot of the surveys, would be better to.
Okay.
You wanted more detail, but let me at least give a stab. I think some of these surveys have begun because right now, you know, as with anything, everybody is planning, assuming that we get approval and can move material to the Santa Maria landfill. And I think the current plan is something, you know, April or May of 2006 to begin construction, I mean, excavation at a number of these sites. And the UNICAL is in the process now of developing, you know, the final detailed designs for the construction. And which order they will go in. And so I think some of these probably have begun. Some of them are seasonal driven for certain plants. You know, certain times of year you need to do it because you can only see them when they're flowering. And I think what will happen is if we can't make that because the appeal is upheld and we have to do something that delays it, then UNICAL will have to rethink what they want to do. And it may very well mean that we may need to go back, or UNICAL may need to go back and redo surveys again prior to work. But I think everybody's going under the assumption now, and it's the safest thing to do, that we're going to begin when we think.
There's under long-term management 8.2, there's reference to a requirement for a public access easement, an open space habitat protection and public access easement that needs to be dedicated, that UNICAL needs to dedicate. And I'm wondering if you have identified an entity that's going to hold that easement?
I think the best person to answer that is somebody from UNICAL. I think I'm not clear exactly what that is.
Okay, so is there a UNICAL representative that
can? I'm Gonzalo Garcia with UNICAL. We've already made the offers to dedicate the conservation easements, and we're in active negotiations with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages the adjacent refuge, to manage our property jointly with them.
Okay.
And so, the process is moving forward, and we are in a kind of working with the federal government, so it takes a little bit longer. But the easements have been offered formally. And
easements, plural? It's not a single easement that covers open space, habitat, and public access?
The entire site, basically. There are two existing easements on the western side of the field. There's a public access and a conservation easement that are already accepted by the State Coastal Conservancy.
Okay.
The remainder of the site actually falls into the portions that are in San Luis County, and there's a small portion in Santa Barbara County, and those have been offered. They're irrevocable OTDs that have been offered.
And they're going to be accepted by the Fish and Wildlife Service, or we don't?
We're in a process that, I can't give you a commitment from their side. We've made the offers. We've met our obligation.
Okay.
And we're just kind of facilitating and working to try and make those easements get recorded.
Okay, but ultimately there will be public access out there.
It'll be managed public access, and that's what the condition actually requires. And the reason for that is because the site is so sensitive. Its ecological services are of such value that there will have to be managed public access.
Understood. And that would begin, the public access out there would begin after the restoration activities have been completed, or?
I think it could actually happen sooner as long as it's controlled, in concert with the construction work. Obviously, we don't want to put the public at risk, but we're certainly willing to work with whoever ends out with the easements to make sure that if there are public access needs, educational outreach through the Dune Center or others, we'd be happy to accommodate that and work that in, providing we can do it safely. That's always going to be the first consideration.
I was just going to comment that it would be perhaps a valuable education opportunity for members of the public and interested parties to sort of see the progress, the ongoing progress of the project itself. So I was happy to see the public access component and was just curious about how that was all going to work. So thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, we actually do some tours now through the Dune Center and stuff, so if you get an opportunity, we welcome you out. If you're interested in seeing the site, welcome you out. Happy to coordinate that with the staff.
Great.
It's a really remarkable site. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any more?
That concludes my questions.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Christie, Figure 4 in Volume 1 actually shows the three easements. It's a fold-out 11 by 7.
What page would Figure 4 be on?
Figure 4, if you go to the Figures tab, which is the last tab in the book, it's going to be the fourth figure.
no page numbers to use, sorry.
For our tablets books.
Oh, wow. Well, it's going to be the very last, near the end.
It's the last fold-out towards the middle of Volume 1.
So we have a easement for limited public access, which is assumed by the Coastal Conservancy on June 5th.
Correct.
And that looks like it's beach stuff.
Yeah.
And then we go back from that. That's easement for habitat protection open space assumed by the Coastal Conservancy. Assumed June 5th, 2001. And then the last one was an offer, and that looks like the vast majority of the site.
Right, and that's the one that Mr. Garcia was talking about relative to U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
And so currently there's an accepted offer to dedicate for public access just along the seaward-most portion of the site. The pending offer to dedicate the conservation easement that's being worked out with Fish and Wildlife Service, will that or will that not include a public access component? It will include a public access component. Okay, thank you for that.
And while we're on that picture, as well as the one that you have up there, it has this little spaghetti maze, which looks like maybe roads and well sites.
Correct.
That's what that...
That's exactly what that is.
And in the end, they will... 30 years from now, no one would ever know those roads and well sites that were there. Would I be correct in assuming that?
I think whether or not all the roads will come out is still an unanswered question. There may be roads needed for access, particularly if there's public for people to get access to the site. I think that is
cleanup. And so until that point, we will hold fee title, but the conservation easements will be held by whatever entity ends out with the easements.
Just for one little bit of detail, the offer to dedicate over the bulk of the remainder of the site, is it contemplated that the Fish and Wildlife Service is the easement holder, or is that up in the air at this point?
No, right now that is the path we've gone down. We actually have several letters of support from various agencies supporting that. There's a lot of public support in the area. The refuge is being managed very well. That's right. The adjacent 2,000 acres. Right. It doesn't make a lot of sense to manage, you know, these right. pieces as islands, so right. we're looking for joint management of it, and that's why we've been working so closely with Fish and Wildlife. We think if Fish and Wildlife isn't the actual entity holding it, they should absolutely be in a partnering arrangement with whoever does. That's, so we're open to working through the process, and you guys are a part of that process, so it will be very transparent as we move forward.
Okay, continuing with my questions, starting off, I too would like to compliment the process. It seems like the working group process where you had all the stakeholders involved just seems to make a whole lot of sense, and hope we can use that in other contentious issues. You used a term disturb. Obviously, this was pristine at some point, and then we brought in some oil wells. So when you refer to disturb, are you talking primarily the process of putting up oil wells and making roads and having sumps, or is this largely the pollutant that leaked out and spread hither, thither, and yon, or a combination thereof?
Well, I think when I used, this is John Pearson, when I used the word they will disturb unavoidable impacts and disturbed wetlands, what we're really referring to here are wetlands that will be disrupted as part of the excavations. Now, what it means is these wetlands were disturbed, or, you know, there was impacts to them when the diluent and other material leaked. There's obviously contamination at some of these wetlands, otherwise they wouldn't be going in there to excavate them. But they are functioning wetlands, and there is wildlife in them, and what they're required to do is to go in and actually excavate these out and remove the material. And so in this document, a lot of times when we talk about disturbed, what we're really referring to is, you know, that they're going to be going in and excavating those and disrupting those wetlands, you know, destroying them or pieces of what's there as part of the excavations, and then they have to restore them.
To get at the contaminated soil that largely lies underneath, but obviously is seeping up as the water surfaces.
Correct.
which segues into my next question. If I was a person or a frog, what would I see there today in one of these sites? What is there, odors of oil, slicks here and there, or is this largely something that's underground and getting worse as it comes up?
I think, you know, I'm not I'm a chemical engineer, so I'm not a botanist or a biologist. So when I go out there and look at them, unless somebody told me that there was contamination in the soils, I wouldn't know. Yes, botanists, there may be some issues that they can see that would say there's something going on here. But for the most part, these are pretty functioning wetlands. It's in the soil below, in a lot of cases, the wetland. There have been a couple of wetlands where there was free-floating, you know, product on top, diluent, and UNICAL in the past has been required to go in and backfill those in so that wildlife does not get into those. So it really depends on which ones you're looking at. But for the most part, I would say, you know, you wouldn't know if you just went out there and started looking at the sites. You wouldn't know that these were contaminated because it's in the soil that's, in a lot of cases, below them.
But you, the chemical engineer who took a sample back to your lab, you would know when you got your results back.
That something's not right, yeah.
Because
you're seeing higher levels of hydrocarbons in the soil or in the groundwater than would naturally be there, yeah. And those levels, in some cases, are high enough that they do represent an ecological risk to the environment. It may not be killing them, you know, acutely, meaning you want exposure and they're dead, but it could be having, you know, genetic effects over a number of generations. So there is some ecological risk, and that is why in a lot of cases, at least from the regional board, there's also potential threat of release of this material to the ocean. Most of these wetlands, as you saw in the figure, are very close to the ocean, and that's the reason under the regional board's cleanup and abatement order, they are required to be excavated and cleaned up, so that they reduce the level of threat to the ocean and also at the same time will reduce the ecological risk to the wildlife and vegetation in these areas.
Okay, now for those who haven't had the benefit to read these three volumes, could somebody just describe in layman's terms what
for disposal? And at that point, at some point, they've dug down far enough, dewatered, and they take samples, and the samples come back from the lab and says you're at a level that is acceptable to the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and therefore you have completed your required excavation at that site.
And how deep would you expect that would
they
be?
They all vary.
Ballpark. We're talking 5 feet, 100 feet?
No, none are 100 feet. Some are a few feet, some are 10 feet, some are 20 feet, but none are 100 feet down. Those may come later, no. Basically, once that is done, then depending on the wetland, if it was not a wetland, then the next thing is they would then take sand from one of the large dune complexes that are out there, what they're called borosite, Q4. It's a huge, large dune. We talked about this when we had our hearing on the trucking. And they would take that sand and they would bring it in and backfill with clean sand. Recontour back to the natural contours and then revegetate. Now, with a wetland, it's different because in this case, we want to keep it deep in some areas because we want open water. There'll be some backfilling. They have now laid out in the detailed plans contours that they're going to achieve after they've excavated for the wetlands. So then, you know, graders and scrapers and stuff will come in and recontour these sites to meet the contours that have been developed by the Restoration Working Group for each of the sites. And once that contouring is done, then the site is turned over to restoration group, who will then come in and begin doing what they have to do in terms of planting different plant, you know, meeting the different plant requirements in terms of what's been laid out for the specific plant species and the different habitats that have to be created at each of the sites, and those will get planted. And there are also, for wildlife and vegetation, there are functions and values. They may decide to set some decaying logs in one of the wetlands to serve as a, you know, for some sort of species in terms of an important function.
That brings up a point. It seems like this dune material is likely to be more or less sterile, and I would assume that what exists there today is some sort of mixture of humus and decayed coyote bush and that sort of thing. And how do we get that back in there?
Yeah, well, part of it is the vegetated overburden that you return to the site. And the other part is it's going to take time. I mean, I think nobody expects within 6 months to have these beautiful, flourishing wetlands. I mean, that's why we've got 10 years. in order to meet these success criteria. You know, we're recreating and trying to do something that took Mother Nature thousands of years to create wetlands. You know, we're trying as best as man can, you know, to recreate that. And it's going to take time for all of that biological activity that you're referring to, really, to establish itself. And, you know, example I would use is anybody that has a saltwater aquarium knows, you know, you set it up, it takes time to get the biological filter and get all of that biological action going. You start, in essence, with a somewhat sterile environment. And, you know, the same is going to have to happen at these wetlands. And it's going to take time for them to establish and to get, you know, let Mother Nature take its hold and begin building her cycles and allow the vegetation to grow. And then the hope is once you get good vegetation growing and through weeding and watering and stuff, that then the wildlife will return. You know, the old saying, you know, if you build it, they'll come. And you try to build in the various functions and values into these wetlands that would attract various types of wildlife. And that's what's been laid out in the success criteria.
Okay.
That's a very cliff note version of what was.
That's what I wanted. That's exactly what I wanted the public to hear. That's all I have. Anyone else? Any more?
I would hope that some of this gets published. I mean, this is like the sunset big book of how to make a wetland. It's outstanding.
I think that for most of the agencies, everybody's very, very pleased with what has been developed. You know, in my experience and what I've seen, this is one of the most detailed, comprehensive plans for a lot of sites.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think UNICAL deserves an awful lot of the credit because they are the ones who went into this process of doing a restoration working group. And as I said earlier, you know, it's not easy to get a large group of people, particularly biologists, to agree. Mm-hmm. And to come to consensus. And they really persevered through it. I'm sure there were times where they were wondering, what did we get ourselves into? And I know I was there many times, though. But I think in the end, the product is outstanding. And everybody, I mean, you know, the staff from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Game, Coastal Commission, they all deserve a lot of credit and put a lot of time and hard work into this.
Okay. It's the last of the commission questions, public hearing. I don't have any speaker slips. Is the, I guess the applicant would be UNICAL. Did UNICAL want to say a few words?
Basically, it's really the same comment I had when we were doing the SEIRs. We're prepared to go. We've committed a lot of resources to this. The fact that we have kind of unanimous support from all the stakeholder agencies and, you know, there's no public outcry. You know, we're doing the right thing, and we're doing that collectively and collaboratively.
Right, and the reason we had to bring back, you know, through a land treatment unit, that really didn't pan out as everybody had hoped, and it has now come to the point where I think everybody's realized that this material has to be hauled off-site, or the recommended approach is to take it to the Santa Maria landfill. But all of the restoration and excavation, that was what was addressed as part of the original 1998 EIR.
Okay. Okay, I have no speaker slips.
Mr. Chairman, John Nall, planning staff, you don't have any speaker slips because of what you've been hearing this morning about the collaborative approach, but we do have several agencies in the audience. They weren't part of the presentation because we wanted to keep it fairly short, but if you have questions for them, we have Fish and Game is here, Regional Water Quality Control Board staff is here, some of the biologists that help prepare the plan are here, so...
I'd love
whatever you'd like.
Own.
Whatever you'd like.
I think the document really speaks for itself.
That's what we thought too.
And our questions, I think, have been adequately answered. So, I'm fine moving ahead with the information that we have at this point.
Okay, we've got 160 minutes, like I told the.
Well, Bob, we don't have to use it. Let's.
I understand that. What I'm trying to say is, those who have projects who thought they were coming up in the afternoon, they better be dropping by because I think we're. Reaching the end of our 160 minutes here. Okay, seeing no one coming forward, going once, going twice, close the public hearing, bring it back to the commission for further discussion and or action.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the wetland restoration mitigation plans as modified per the Department of Fish and Game and Coastal Commission requests outlined in the December 8th supplemental information package.
And I'll second that.
All right, we have motion, discussion, roll call.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Milskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Chairman Rose?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Kind of out of order there, but that's okay. We all sounded unanimous, okay. Okay, thank you all very much. And to get ready, let's take a 15-minute break and come back at 5 after 10.
Track 2759, conditional use permit to construct an 80-unit multifamily condominium project that includes 20 moderate-income units. County file number SUB2004-00384, Supervisorial District 4, Jay Johnson, project manager.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the commission, it's been a while since I've seen you. It's been a year.
And so,
good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Jay Johnson, planning staff. It's been about a year since I've been here. We have some new commissioners, and it's a pleasure to be here. What I'd like to do this morning is, because we do have some new commissioners, give a brief history of the Woodlands, then explain the structure of the specific plan and why this case is actually before you this morning. And then quickly go through my slides and hit the major project elements and then answer questions. The Woodlands in the South County order of things is west of Napomo, just east of Highway 1, and you can see on your screen the other villages in the South County planning area. The Woodland specific plan, which took several years to develop and process the environmental impact report, starting probably in the late 80s and then more officially in 1994, was adopted and approved by the Board of Supervisors in 1998. The tentative map that approved the over 1,300 lots was done in 2002 in December. And then last year, the commissioners that were here at the time can recall that we did a specific plan amendment to switch the multifamily site with another feature of the overall project and to increase the density of the multifamily feature from 80 units to 100 units, with 1,320 units remaining the cap on the overall project as originally approved. On the screen, you can see that this is a small portion of Phase 1A of the Woodlands site. And the way the specific plan is structured is that your commission should be looking at development plans for the major phases, the four major phases. This is an overall site of the color graphic of the Woodlands, and you can see where the multifamily project is, and we have a blow-up of that. And if you look up above the multifamily site here to where it says recreation facility, that's where the multifamily site used to be located. One of the goals in when we reviewed switching these sites was to keep the multifamily in a reasonable walking distance to the village center near the monarch butterfly habitat park, which is just to the right of the multifamily development, so that the folks in the higher density area can have access to those project features. This is the aerial from our system that was taken probably in the summer of 2003, thereabouts, and you can see we had already issued the permits to begin tree removal. The butterfly habitat site is pointed out as also where the multifamily site would be located. Since that time, a great deal of activity has happened on the project, and the trees have been cleared at the multifamily site. This is an aerial provided by the applicants. This is probably several months old. I don't know exactly when. You can see the golf course has been seeded. A lot of the initial phases of the single-family homes are being built in the background, and the tree removal for Phase 1A has been completed. the major street via Concha that this project will front on is today, if you drove out there, is installed, and so is Eucalyptus Avenue, and then Kingston Drive that drives goes around the back side of the multifamily project into the butterfly habitat area is also in. This is a slide taken actually this week on the site. Again, it's already been graded. That was allowed through the approval of the original Phase 1A, and the trees in the background is the... When I talk about the butterfly habitat, this is about 11 acres that really protects the couple dozen trees within a two-acre portion of that where the butterflies go. And the butterflies are there at this site just as they are at Pismo Beach at this time. Another slide of the same. In the staff report, I had mentioned that we need to increase the usable open area of the project and to increase the number of collection sites for solid waste and recyclables. The applicants have responded to this, and if you look toward the middle of the site, you can see that if you compare that to the site plan in your staff report, they've added some more usable green area. I think this can be improved somewhat, but the way the conditions are worded, we don't need to change any of the conditions to achieve a more usable open area for this site. As Ramona mentioned, this is 80 units. That's anticipated with the specific plan. The specific plan requires an affordability component to the project, and the applicants are responding to that by providing 20 units at the moderate affordable level. And this is an illustrative example of the architecture. Well, we wanted something to keep these in small runs of row houses rather than having a long dormitory feel to it, to where the buildings are 5 to 8 units per row. Each unit is meant to have a usable patio area, and then some of the smaller units also have an outside deck on the second floor to where folks have some private use areas as well. That concludes my staff report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Staff's recommending approval of the subdivision map and the conditional use permit based on the findings and conditions.
Okay.
Mr. Dean? Chairman, yes, I have one question. On the common area, you're proposing that 4 parking lots not be created and to enlarge the common area by using those in that, converting them to the common area?
Correct. This is one of the things we as staff take a look at is parking. If a site happens to be over-parked based on the ordinance, then we like to take advantage of that and trade some gray for green, if you will. And this is a great opportunity is in the center of the site to reduce some parking that isn't necessary under the ordinance.
Okay.
And to put it to, we think, a better use.
But have you designed that yet? You don't have it? You have anything?
The applicants on the previous slide have done a very good job. If you look to the middle of the project where I have the pointer right now, is this graphic is an improvement over what was in your staff report. And our opinion as staff is that this can be improved.
All right, thank you.
Anyone else?
Chair.
Ms. Rappa?
I have a question. I didn't have an opportunity to look up the section 22-12-070 or that deals with the criteria for establishing the affordability component. Can you just sort of outline what our land use ordinance says?
Certainly. What that section is speaking to is really not in terms of an affordability density bonus, which that part of our ordinance focuses primarily on. What this does is assure that it meets the level of affordability, that it addresses the correct families, persons that will be buying these units, and it establishes the long-term viability of that so that this doesn't fade away. It gives a 30-year time frame for this to remain in in so
the form. The ordinance gives a 30-year time limit.
Correct.
And then as far as the initial sales price or income level or something, what does the ordinance say?
Well, that's what it specified. It's based on the, and I don't have the, I'd have to ask the housing division, but it's based on current statistics of the appropriate, and I just beg your pardon, I don't know which source that is, but it's spelled out in the ordinance as to what criteria is to use to help establish the initial sales price and the correct clientele that will be buying the units. So that's spelled out, how that's done is spelled out in the ordinance. And then the long-term viability of the affordability is also spelled out in the ordinance.
Jay, maybe I could add a little bit. It's sort of a two-step process. Prior to recordation of the map, basically at the time of recordation of the map, there's an agreement entered into with the county to provide 20 affordable units. And then each time a buyer comes, there's a separate agreement for each separate buyer that has a 30-year time period on it. And the low and moderate is, I think, 120% of medium. It gets adjusted monthly. And so at the time of recordation of the map, we say that you're going to enter into this agreement, and that's when we set forth the prices to be adjusted. For example, if the map records and the houses don't get built and rented till a year later, over time, every month, there's going to be an adjustment of those prices. And so that's built into the agreement, and it's in the ordinance, too.
Yeah, I understand about the agreements. I guess I was sort of looking for what income level are we talking about?
The 120% of medium. And that
for those of us who don't do 120% of median, could you just give us a number? It's really a straightforward question.
If I had Ted Bench's document in front of me, I could give it to you. As I recall, I believe the last agreement I did was around 290 or 300,000 for a two-bedroom.
I have it from 04.
And then there's a separate for there's one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom. And each month there's a different figure that comes out.
I understand.
Mr. Chair, I have some of that information. It's a little bit outdated. I just happen to have the 2004 dollar amounts. So they're not current, but they'll give you a baseline.
That would be helpful.
And what we were talking about, median income?
Moderate.
Oh, lower moderate. That's 120%.
What does a moderate income household make annually? Is the question.
Okay. And Jay, what size families are we talking about in these units?
I don't think there's a specification on
okay.
size of family.
For a family of four in 2004, moderate income was defined as $74,050.
Now, that's the income level. There's also
yes.
a sales price level.
Well, there should be a quantifiable relationship between
there is.
The income level and the sales price. Am I correct?
Yes, there is. It's specified in the ordinance. Now, for a three-bedroom unit for moderate, the initial sales price in 2004 was pegged at $315,255.
Thank you.
Jay,
I'll call to see if we can get the 2005 figures over here.
That would be fine, but I think that answered my question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I had an additional question about that. I noticed the staff report discussed 16 minimum required, and they're offering 20. I assume that's what the condition is. Because I was looking at page 2, affordable housing.
At a certain point, and they're estimating them at $13.8 million. Do you know when that would happen? Is it at a certain phase when certain projects they're allowed to build, or do you have any information on that?
Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. We're in the process of negotiating an agreement with the Woodlands developer to stage the payment of the total fees for the project over, I think it's 5 years. It might be a different number of years, but that's the basic concept. And What we would do is at any given time that building permits are being issued, if they're already sufficiently paid up, then the permits are issued, and if they're not, then they would have to pay the individual fee for that permit. And in fact, some permits have already started, even though the agreement is in progress, so they've been paying individual permit fees the regular way on those early permits.
I'm not quite clear. It is tied to issuing of permits, or is not?
The ordinance minimum requirement is that your individual building permit has to pay its fee before getting the mm-hmm. permit issued. Mm-hmm. Woodlands is entering into an agreement with the county where they're going to advance the payment of the fees a lot earlier than that. But that agreement is still in progress. We haven't finished that process.
Okay,
so meanwhile, we're using the regular way
until
that's finished.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And to segue off that, they're paying the if they went into a building permit today, they're paying the fee today. And if we approve this and they come in for a building permit 60 days from now or I think you're going to redo the South County fees shortly.
I think it's next Tuesday.
So.
And then it would become effective 60 days later.
Okay, so 3 months from now they come in for a permit for this. What fee would they pay then, assuming
if
the board?
If they hadn't prepaid through this agreement by then they would pay the then current fee.
Okay, and in 5 years from now they would pay the fee that was in place
exactly.
5 years from now.
I think that's part of the incentive for the developer to enter this agreement. Otherwise, what's in it for them to pay the fees earlier than they're owed is that they'll get to pay for X number of trips at today's price before the price goes up.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt there.
All right. No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for staff?
I have two questions for Mr. Johnson.
You've got to get red off, green
red.
On.
Green's on. Mr. Johnson, you said that when this was originally approved, it was conceived as basically rental apartments. Is that correct? And the fact that they want to condominiumize it instead for the purpose of individual sale is why it's back before us.
No, I apologize. I didn't make that wholly clear. The specific plan allows for the condominium, so they had the choice of doing them as rentals or condominiums. If it were rentals only, then it would be at the minor use permit level. Because it's a condominium, it has to be here.
Okay, so the concept of having individually owned condominiums was considered by the commission's previous action.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then the other question I had related to the condition of no pesticide use between October and March. Is that for the purpose of protecting the Monterey or the monarch butterflies in their adjacent habitat, is this just for construction between October and March, or is this ongoing for the life of the project that the residents there can't use pesticides between October and March?
This is an ongoing condition that would apply to not just this project, but any within a certain distance of the
Okay.
butterfly.
Well, in that case, I don't know if it's appropriate to make the suggestion now, but I will go ahead. If that's going to be a requirement of the residents, I suggest that be posted so that people are reminded once they're living in the units that pesticide use is prohibited, since I don't assume that county enforcement is going to be down there checking on people's herbicide use. But could we add a condition for sign posting?
We could, a point of clarification, if I might, is that I'm picturing a physical post somewhere maybe in the walkway near the it's outside near the butterfly habitat.
Small, unobtrusive, but readily seen by the residents.
That can be done.
Is there a consensus for that?
Well, maybe we could expand that just a little bit, because there's a condition regarding barbecue smoke and things like that, and just maybe just generalize it to some proper kind of notification as to protections for the butterfly habitat. And I've got a couple questions on that.
And I think that'd be fine. I think signs is the appropriate notification, as opposed to putting something in the mail every year to residents and they just throw it away, because this just sort of reminds them that they live close to the monarchs and that they
need. Planning department, at a minimum, provide for ongoing maintenance of a drainage basin and so forth. Is the maintenance of the common areas, is there a specific entity that is responsible for that? They don't appear to specifically reference an entity there.
The applicant can probably elaborate on this.
Maybe I could add, Jay, since it's a condominium, there's a requirement there be a homeowners association. I was going to suggest that in the third line of condition 19, you add the CC&R shall establish a homeowners association and provide, and then have the following items remain unchanged. But there's a requirement of a homeowner association that will maintain it.
That seems logical to me. In that, down at the bottom, 19E references the no barbecues and only EPA-approved fireplaces. Is there a reason that that's a year round? A couple of things, and one of them has to do with specificity, because elsewhere I saw that condition was part of minimizing wood smoke pollution. This is on 2.9, item 15B. It says minimize wood smoke pollution by allowing no barbecues and only EPA-approved fireplaces within a quarter mile of the habitat. We're getting down to a level of pretty serious detail here, but is that a October to March issue? Are gas barbecues allowed? That one just seems hard to enforce, and I think we might make it more efficient if we put all those things necessary to protect the butterfly habitat into one coherent package there.
The language in these conditions are directly out of the environmental impact report as prepared, though that particular issue prepared by Dr. Leong, who is the specialist for the butterflies. So they're in two places in the staff report so that we can get them
together.
One's places for us to administer and one's in the CC&R so they could self-administer.
I understood that.
I've always thought through the years that that's a little difficult to address. However, I would hesitate to change that without input from.
Okay. Well, we can hear again. It goes to no. I mean, if that's a serious thing that we have to prohibit barbecues because of the butterfly habitat within a quarter mile, and I don't know, you want to draw a bright red line down the street, I assume that you can get a quarter mile away from the. There's just a level of detail there that seemed to make that a bit problematic. Let me go back to, first of all, since you've got it on the screen, in the staff report it indicates that that the site coverage of buildings in this project is only 43%. And am I looking at 43% site coverage of buildings in what I see right there?
Correct.
Okay. I mean, it looks
like bigger than that.
It looks
35%.
It does when you look at, especially on a color graphic, when you paint a street the same color as the houses, more or less, it really, and the streets are part of the open area. So I do a real detailed calculation on that number.
Okay.
And streets are part of the open area, why?
For light and flow of air, as is the portion of it. It's just, we also balance, that's why we also look at passive and usable green spaces as well. But the ordinance has been that way since 1980, that you don't count the parking spaces, but you count the driveways and whatnot as part of the open area.
And one other thing is doesn't show well on our screen is down to the lower left-hand corner. There's a bit of green sward there that has a trail running through it that's also part of the property. I mean, are we looking at exactly the property line?
Actually, the property line is... that's the green space that's not even counted. That's part of the right of way. The property line, if you look on the screen, would along Via Concha there is this line right here. If you can follow the pointer.
Okay.
So we're following that row of trees.
Correct, okay. More or less.
As opposed to that really, really light green with
right.
the trailer?
The light green will be a significant amount of open area that's not part of that calculation.
Okay, and then just looking, do you have, or could you direct us real quickly to the, basically the roadways there where the cars are shown, is that sort of pure access points there? I mean, it's all garages and, you know, what's the elevation along that street look like, I guess is my question.
You know, density is still the right. same at 20 units per acre maximum, but the extra, the additional 20 available multifamily units are allowable in the village center, which will be an application that the specific plan brings back to you. So you'll be getting a look at the village center probably next year sometime. And a significant component of that is to include apartments above the retail space.
Okay. And the specific plan had just simply it designated this as residential multifamily without specifying whether it's condos or rentals. Is that
correct? The specific plan is actually very clear to allow it to be either.
Okay. Okay. And was there any affordability requirement within the rental? If they went rentals, was there a specific affordability, or was that a phase 1A total kind of concept?
The affordability is for the overall project, and that affordability, as our ordinance allows, can be for sale units or rental units. Okay. It wasn't mandated to be one or the other.
Okay. I think it's my last question on page 29. Item 17, that the applicant shall notify prospective buyers of the county's right to farm ordinance. I think everybody should know about the right to farm ordinance, but I didn't quite catch whether there was specific agricultural use nearby, and was wondering where that came from.
The agricultural use are nearby of the Woodlands Village, so we okay. place that on any of
anything
the,
in
any of the cases.
I think it should be posted in the common areas as well, but that's because I'm a farmer. So that's all I have.
Okay, I'd like to acknowledge that Mr. Hoag has, through the beauty of the phone, given us the affordable housing standards for today that are in effect today.
Yes, if I might briefly address the commission on that point, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Warren Hoag, Department of Planning and Building. These are the most current standards, and they were updated on December 1st of this year. And a three-bedroom unit, the moderate income limit for monthly rents would be $1,345, and the limit for sale units would be $281,263. In a family of four, the moderate income limit, which is defined as 120% of county median income, that would be $74,050. And I also wanted to note that we do have one of our housing planners here available, Ted Bench. If you have any detailed questions on some of this, he can assist us in answering any further questions you may have.
Okay, I think this says it all, unless anybody have any questions for Mr. Bench?
It's very helpful. Thank you for getting that to us, Mr.
Right. Bench. I heard what you said, but I like it in front of me because I can...
I thought you'd like to have your own copy.
I can grasp it now. Okay. No more questions. Then this is public hearing. Is the applicant here?
Thank you, Commission, members of the Commission and staff. My name is Brad Breckwald with the Wallace Group, and I want to thank you for the questions today. They're numerous good questions, and I also want to thank Jay for all his work putting together the staff report and his long history on this project, because he has quite a bit of a history. Also today with us is a couple people who've also got some history on the project, Allison Donatello from RRM, involved in the overall project through the planning process. We have Ken Bornholt, and we have our client, who's Woodlands Ventures, LLC, and that's Jim Maloja and Tom Whalen. And the project architect is Lenny Grant from LGA. So if you have any questions for any of us, we'd be glad to answer them. Again, it's a 80-unit condominium project on 5.5 acres. It was addressed through the specific plan amendment and also proposed as part of the original overall project scope for the Woodlands Ventures, or for the Woodlands project. The project is located, as indicated on the slides, adjacent to the butterfly habitat and near the village center. We have clustered the townhomes, and Jay basically has used most of my slides already, so I'm not going to go through them again, but I'll just talk from the one in front of us. We've clustered the townhomes into 13 clustered buildings, ranging from 5 to 8 units each. And as indicated, the access ways are pretty much access to the garages, and the fronts of the units are facing the greener open space areas. The project includes 20 units as affordable, and in addition to that, they're also paying the housing and lieu fee, which is required of any subdivision. Regarding the comments that have been made today, the
comments, is that correct?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
So they would fall into the price range of a little over $280,000, somewhere around there?
That's correct.
And they would have deed restrictions as far as 30-year?
For the affordable.
Right. Congratulations. Thank you.
You bet.
Okay, I had a couple. Mr. Breckwell and I had a conversation on the phone yesterday, and I told him I was going to ask him this question. When we heard the project back 2 or 3 years ago, there was water was an issue, and one of the points that the water consultant or the hydrologist had made was that you cut the trees down, you're going to lessen the amount of evapotranspiration, and evidently you've cut quite a few trees down. And has that changed anything? Have water levels come up again? I know water levels are really a long-term thing, so, and it's only been a year or two since all the trees were gone. So have you seen any changes? Has what he, Mr. Cleath, proposed actually happened?
I did get a chance to talk to Tim Cleath about that and asked him if that was quantifiable. He said no, it's a very difficult thing to quantify. Also, some further discussions found out that they didn't actually take credit for those trees as part of their water balance, even though it was mentioned as part of a benefit of the project to actually remove the eucalyptus because they do use water. But as far as able to quantify it from the well levels, he said he had no way of figuring out how to do that, just like any other analysis.
Okay. The next question is relates to your building attached condos, and I congratulate you for that. We've been told in other projects that it's very difficult to do that these days, and so we see a lot of projects that are in residential multifamily, and rather than build some attached units, they build essentially little residential single-family homes, and thus don't get the density that the general plan had envisioned for that area. And I'm told through a couple of conferences that that's largely an insurance thing and something to do with condo associations and lawyers. And how have you managed to succeed at this, where others have failed?
Well, again, that is an issue that is brought up on all projects as to whether they can get the insurance for condominiums. This particular developer is comfortable getting that insurance to cover them as a condominium project. I don't know if Lenny or anybody else wants to expand on that, but
I'd appreciate hearing how he did it, and we keep hearing others can't. Maybe you could take the other microphone there, and you can stay up there, Mr. Breckwell.
Jim Malogia with the Woodlands Ventures. There's no question that condominiums have been a difficult thing to build in our profession. That is because of the number of lawsuits that are usually filed in the ninth year, flat out. There's no other reason to look at what the problem is. In order to accomplish that today, we have to actually insure all the subcontractors. We have to pay an insurance policy that's called a wrap insurance. That wrap insurance, in addition to our course of construction and our liability policy, is about $15,000 for each unit. That's what allows us to go forward and build this product. It basically, from the time we complete the product, it provides what we call a 10-year tail, so that during the time of the statute in the state of California for our liability, we have insurance in place to cover us for the potential of homeowner's action or any other deficiency.
Mr. Chairman.
In other words, it sounds like you can do it if you want to.
Well, jack up the price, $15K, though, I would expect. Mr. Hogue, did you have something to add?
I was asking the speaker to spell his name for the secretary.
That's L-A-L-O-G-G-I-A.
Thank you. Another member from your team there, Mr. Breckwald.
Hi, Lenny Grant with LGA Architecture. And anyways, I'll step outside for a second of my architect representing Mr. LaLoggia for a second. I'm also the president of the local chapter of the American Institute of Architects. So we've been looking at this issue not only from individual projects for my office, but also region-wide. And I will tell you that it is difficult. It isn't just something that people are choosing to do or not to do. There's actually, we just renewed our insurance in our office, and we're limited to 15% of our total gross revenues. So of our about $1.5 million a year in fees, we're looking at approximately $225,000 a year. These are difficult, complex projects. I could probably do three or four a year. This one's a little bit larger than most of the ones we're doing, but we do about 100 projects a year. So we're including this on their construction wrap policies, which, by the way, are very, very expensive, $10,000 to $20,000 per unit. So it's not easy. It's very, very difficult, and I applaud them for trying to do a project like this.
Thank you. Anyone else from your team, Mr. Breckwald?
No, thank you.
Okay. Then this is a public hearing. Anyone from the public here to address the commission on this matter? I have no speaker slips. Going once, going twice. Any concluding remarks, Mr. Breckwald? No? Okay. Then I'll close the public hearing, bring it back to the commission for further discussion and or action.
Let me simply disclose a short conversation with Mr. Grant yesterday regarding process here, not of substance of the project.
Has staff come up with suggested language for the additional condition for signage?
I have, thank you. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I would simply add a condition 30 on page 211 to the conditional use permit that says per condition.
Wait a minute.
You there?
Which page?
On page 211.
211, I'm sorry. I had 30 in my hand, and okay, no. Condition 30, okay.
Let's see. Per condition, I had this, 15A, the ban on pesticides shall be posted within the project site. And then to work out where that could be, then on page 2-7, add 6C, that says this would be the revised site plan that was reviewed by staff, to add sign locations per condition 30. So we get the signs in condition 30, and then we get the location of the signs in condition 6C.
Thank you for that. With that, I'd like to move that we approve Vestive tentative.
You didn't want to let the commissioner from the district
make the motion?
No,
I'm
no,
just
go
trying
ahead.
To move things along.
Okay. We appreciate that.
I move that we approve Vesting tentative tract 2759 as modified, based on the findings listed in Exhibits A and C and the conditions listed in Exhibits B and D.
I'll second that.
And summarizing the what we changed on Exhibit B, we had the 6C and 30 that Mr. Johnson just remembered, and on condition or Exhibit D, we had the condition 2B brought or. I'll get it from Exhibit B, Condition 2, duplicated in that. Is that correct, County Council?
Correct, number 22.
And also number 19, which would have just a couple of words inserted, which would be the CCNR shall establish and provide.
Okay, great.
Establish a homeowners association and pick it up.
Okay, hopefully Secretary's got all those. Great, she's nodding her head yes. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Seeing none, roll call.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
We got.
Yeah. It was Commissioner Christie
made the motion. Okay, and
Commissioner Christie.
Yes.
Commissioner Malskow.
Yes.
Commissioner Gibson.
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa.
Yes.
Chairman Rose.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm moving right along. Item number 3. Could we introduce that item, please?
Hearing to consider a proposal by William G. Kangle for reconsideration of the Planning Commission's decision approving vesting tentative tract map 2299, including allowing a retaining wall / fence height of 1 foot or lot for lot 11, 2 feet for lot 12, and 3 feet for lot 13. County file number S980005T, Supervisorial District 4, Chuck Stevenson, project manager.
Good morning, Chairman Rose, members of the commission. Chuck Stevenson.
Excuse me,
Mr. Belskar. I
need to announce that I met with the applicant 2 days ago, and we walked the site and looked at the wall and everything, and so I'll report on that later.
And I had a phone conversation with the gentleman.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. I just wanted to mention, I think, at least a couple of commissioners are not familiar with the rather colored history of this project, so I'll go into a little bit of detail.
We received all the Planning Commission reports, and
you've read
through. I've read the background.
Of course they did.
Of course you did.
Oh my goodness,
of
Chuck! Well, you're suggesting that.
And I assume you did.
Yeah.
This is a reconsideration of a tract, one particular aspect of a tract, Tract 2299. It was approved by the Planning Commission. Let me get you oriented here. This is off of Orchard Street in town of Napomo, just south of Tefts. What we're looking at is the graded slope along the south property line, and that's roughly what a 2-to-1 slope.
Could you go back a bit and wiggle your pointer to...
Oh, okay. This area right here is the southern boundary of the tract that we're talking about. The property to the right over in here is owned by Mr. Lonnie Case, who, by the way, is also in the audience today and will be providing some testimony in a few minutes. This graphic depicts a couple of things. One, the brown line that's depicted here represents roughly the slope that was approved with the tract originally. It came down to the south property line, is depicted here by this finished grade. And then there would be a 6-foot fence constructed at the property line. Then this graphic depicts lots 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16 along the south property line. And it shows in the labeling below what your commission approved. So for lot 11, you approved a 1-foot retaining wall with a 6-foot-6 fence located directly above it. Lot 12 was a 2-foot wall with a 6-foot fence above it. And lot 13 was a 3-foot wall with a 6-foot-6 fence above it, and then continuing on the balance of lots 14, 15, and 16 was a 4-foot wall. What's happened since your commission approved the reconsideration is Mr. Kangle poured a continuous 4-foot wall along these lots. That wall is in, and this is the proposal is to continue that with a 6-foot fence above it. And we, of course, reminded Mr. Kangle that this would in turn require a reconsideration because he did not follow your commission's direction. This is what the wall looks like today in sections, a construction drawing for that. I try to depict here on this graphic, this is the existing wall as it's poured. It's a 4-foot wall approximately with a 6-foot fence above it. I try to depict with these lines what it would represent. What it would look like had he constructed it according to your previous approval. So this would be the 1-foot retaining wall, and then this would have been a wood fence height above it. And as it would step up in this manner. Now, Mr. Kangle will tell you that the reason he did this was to provide more usable rear yard area for the parcels above and to help prevent an overlook condition into the case's rear yard property. This is a picture that I took the other day from standing in Mr. Case's rear yard and looking toward the wall. These are a couple of photos, a series of photos taken from Orchard Street. Your commission at the time of the previous reconsideration was concerned about public views, that is, the view from Orchard. And so you can see it's rather tall, and right now it's not landscaped to screen it, so it doesn't really stick out. And this view is a partial view of Mr. Case's property with the wall behind it. This is Mr. Case's house right here. This is a look from Lot 13 above Mr. Case's property, and it depicts the extended rear yard area. This was clearly a benefit to the property above on Lot 13 by allowing it quite a bit of additional usable yard area. The only issue that it potentially raises is overlook, but in standing here, you can see it's not really a direct view down into their yard. Another shot of that. This graphic depicts the pad elevations and the relative height of the wall. So this line here represents the 4-foot wall height. These dashed lines represent the finished grades of lots 12, 13, and 11. And just to show that with a wood fence above that, it would help to soften that overlook down into it. So what's proposed as conditions, and by the way, I mentioned that I gave out to you this morning revised conditions. Did you happen to get those?
Yes.
You all have those? I worked out a few changes in cooperation with Mr. Case, the property owner, and Mr. Kingle. What we've come up with is similar to what was proposed before. This is we would stucco color coat the wall, and the fence and wall would be planted with a vine material that would eventually. And that concludes my report.
Questions of staff? Gene?
Like I stated, I went out a couple days ago and looked at it with Mr. Kingle, and we walked on the new development up on top to see how that looks from that direction, and then we went down on the street below and looked from that direction. And on Mr. Cummings' residence, which has been in longer, they have bottle brush bushes that are hiding the concrete portion and are going up and also hiding some of the wooden wall. And from the street, then I drove the street, and you can't see it at all. The house hides the center portion. You might see a little bit around between the two houses, but it's well hidden. You can't see it. And I understand the Cummings are satisfied with how it came out. The rest of the wall, of course, doesn't have the landscaping yet, but I think it can look just as well once it gets finished. He's going to coat the concrete portion the same color and as the house to match that, and I think these new landscaping that they have agreed upon will hide it very well. And if you look on 3-8 and 3-9, it shows you how it helps hide the vision from above down into the neighbor's yard, and also creates a much leveler backyard for more usable space for the upper resident.
Did it? Anyone else? I had one. Who's going to, obviously the applicant here is going to put these vines and trees every 20 feet, but who's going to water them and maintain them in perpetuity? Whose responsibility will that be?
Mr. Kingle has agreed to provide water to the vines and to the trees.
Okay, but Mr. Kingle is probably going to sell those homes, and where will the water come from?
He can explain that to you in a little more detail.
Okay. The next question I have is, I recall this project when Where did we go wrong? Why didn't we come up with a solution in the first place? I thought we kind of compromised and came up with the stepped wall thing, and we all thought we were doing the right thing at the time.
I believe that the commission's concern was from visual, from Orchard primarily, and that by keeping the height of the wall down would satisfy that concern. That seemed to be the major point, as I recall. This solution was suggested at the time by Mr. Kingle, but the commission rejected that in favor of the stepped wall.
Okay, this is a public hearing. I will open the public hearing. Is the applicant ready to make a presentation?
I don't think they're going to read. This won't read.
Really?
They won't be able to read these.
Or I could pass.
I've got this in graphic on my.
Maybe just pass.
Okay. I think Mr. Kingle has asked me to put some things on the overhead, but I don't think they're going to project.
And then we have to keep them, or at least make copies of them if we do see them.
Oh. It wouldn't take that long just to pass them down.
Okay, you understand we have to keep them to make that part of the public record?
Certainly. Actually, this is a letter that I've written to Supervisor Concha.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the speaker needs to come and announce himself. And
there's a mic right
there. Yeah, you could come to a mic here. And give us your name and get the electronics working. And
hello.
Hello, we hear you. Thank you.
I'm Bill Kingle. I'm the applicant. This material that I've given Chuck here is from this larger letter which went to Supervisor Ashajan. And so this is all a matter of public record. Its items have been taken from this. And
you can place these on here.
Okay.
Mr. Kingle, I might suggest that it might be more effective to just address the commission because we can't really read what you're putting up there on our screen and listen to you at the same time. So.
Okay. Explain a lot.
And we have a copy of that in our staff report.
You have that already. Right here is probably most explanatory. This is a copy showing how the view.
We have all this information, and I think that our district representative, has referenced that in his discussions with you. Just trying to help you out by maybe not.
Okay. Hey, why don't you make it easy? Just go over to that mic there, and you can have a little papers will be at your eye view and.
Am I on now?
Oh, you are. You can just stand up normal there. It's good, Mike.
Okay. Moving beyond that, I have a request here from the Cummings family, and I've underlined just one sentence here. Mr. Kingle plans to raise the level of his track 8 to 10 feet at our lot line. This leaves us facing an 8 to 10 foot bluff on our back lot line, threatening runoff erosion and loss of privacy. To go on, to accept the 10 foot bluff on our border, please allow us to protect ourselves in some way, a 6 foot cement wall with a 6 foot six fence on top. This is dated July 2nd, 2003. and it's a request that has been in the staff reports from that time. In other words, the Cummings are requesting this wall, not just 4 feet high, but rather 6 feet high.
Right, and we have that letter in our packet.
Okay, and you should have a similar letter from the Case family where they're requesting a 4 to 6 foot high wall.
So, we do.
We do.
So obviously they agree to this since they've requested it that way. I have a letter here from the Napomo Community Advisory Council with their letterhead saying, we will be contacting county planning and our supervisor, Katsu Ashajan, stating that the Napomo Community Advisory Council has never opposed a retaining wall at this location and that the council supports the county ordinance that pertains to grading and drainage. I don't know if you have that one in there, but NCAC has said here that...
That we don't have, but you're paraphrasing it for us, and we appreciate that.
Okay, and it's in the letter to Supervisor Cacho. What brought this to a head, and the reason that I poured the wall in contradictorily to the 1, 2, and 3 foot height, on April 27th, I received a letter from the Department of Public Works stating that the notice of expired right of entry. They claim that my right of entry to access for construction this wall and so forth has expired. And it goes on to say a new agreement needs to be negotiated because it's apparent that the work in your project requiring access to the Case property is not complete. I talked to Richard Marshall about this, and he said, see your attorney. And I said, my attorney wrote the contract and assures me it's not expired. But anyway, that's not a point for discussion here.
Okay, let's not go over it then.
Now, moving down on this letter, please note that the Public Works Department will not release occupancy for any home in this tract until the retaining wall work is completed, or at least a new right of entry agreement is negotiated with Mr. and Mrs. Case. Well, Mr. Case, who's here in the audience here right now, their complaint was that this thing had gone on so long. In other words, they wanted the wall the way we did it, but it turned out to be a two-year argument over something that could have been handled in 2 days. My readings on the subject indicate that this should have been approved as a permit, as a ministerial act by staff. It never should have come to this commission in the first place. But now that we're here, well, we're moving on. That's referenced in... Actually, in the condition, the assessment district is $125 a year per person. It's a 15-lot tract, and it comes out on the county tax rolls. And we felt that this is a much better solution in the Homeowners Association to simply provide water and upkeep, and that watering and upkeep will be done by... either NCSD or county personnel.
So provisions for the maintenance and upkeep will be handled through an assessment district.
Through an assessment district, yes. And so the water is already being accounted for to pay for this irrigation plus other irrigation on Orchard Street.
Good.
We've got all that set up.
I have one last question for you. The wall that was sort of unpermitted or something, I'd like some assurance from you and Public Works or county staff can weigh in here as necessary that this wall was built to the proper standards for the weight of the dirt and the water drains. All this was done so it is a legal wall as it...
Absolutely. The wall was... The structure was engineered by Russ Filzer, was inspected by Westland Engineering. The soil compaction was tested by Earth Systems. I've got all the documentation.
Okay, and Public Works is in general agreement with that response?
Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. We haven't reviewed any plans or any materials regarding this wall because it hasn't yet been approved for construction by your commission.
Okay, well, will you review, assuming we did approve it, would you review those documents?
Approval, we would review those documents.
And if it's not, doesn't have enough rebar in it, you'd make them put the right amount of rebar in it? Or?
I suppose that might involve reconstructing it, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would just call your attention to Condition 2, which requires that Mr. Kingle submit a construction permit together with engineered construction plans for the wall and with surcharge. And we would either be reviewing it through our office or through Public Works. Either way would be okay.
Okay.
Could we make that condition read as built plans? I've seen that submit a construction permit application together with engineered construction plan as built. Would that be the right terminology? I mean, we need to document, you know, rather than what was planned, what he's representing has actually gone in.
That would be fine.
Okay.
And I would add to that this will take me about one day because I've got all the engineering.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
It's a no-brainer.
Does anyone else have any questions?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you. I have one speaker slip, Lonnie Case.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Lonnie Case. I live at 880 Theodora, which is up on the screen there. And I'm happy the wall's in. It's taken a long time, a lot of phone calls, a lot of arguing, a lot of being upset by him putting the trees in and the vines on my side. I will take care of that, you know, the pruning and whatever. And I'll be more than happy if he puts the trees in to my satisfaction and just get on with it, you know. And I'm sure the wall is poured with all the right stuff because he poured, I think it was in September 2003, I think, when he poured the first part of it. And we had a planning commission hearing on it, and I was kind of upset because we didn't follow through a lot. And so now it's done, excuse me, and I'm happy that it's in and it's finished, and I can go ahead and get my yard landscaped the way I want. And I've caused Bill King a lot of grief over it, and I'm sure, but I wanted to get progress, and I'm all for it.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the last speaker slip I have. Anyone else want to address the commission on this matter? Seeing no one coming forward, since you and I are in agreement, I presume there's no need to make any concluding remarks. Seeing a negative response, close the public hearing and bring it back to the commission for further discussion and action.
I'm wondering on this handout that Chuck Stevenson gave us on conditions on number 4, we can put where it says parcel A, where the addition parcel A and B, track 1015, but as built. The wall's already in. And then on 5, after perpetuity, by way of assessment district.
Is that a motion?
And I will move to approve with modifications from the proposal.
It was beyond the applicant's control. This was a knowing and willful violation of very specific permit conditions, and I won't be supporting the motion.
And I could agree with Commissioner Christie, and I think the proper way to handle that, if you didn't agree with the Planning Commission's decision, was to appeal it to the Board of Supervisors.
Correct.
And you'll pay a much smaller fee than you do for another Planning Commission hearing.
And I will agree with Commissioner Christie also, but since the issue at hand here seems to be one property owner to property owner, and those issues have been resolved to the mutual satisfaction of all, I can, in this case, support the motion.
I can agree with that. Roll call.
Commissioner Malskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
No.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. Okay, that concludes item 3. Could we introduce item 4, please?
Hearing to consider a request by Harvey Billig for a third time extension for a development plan for the construction of a 110,551 square foot, 192 bed medical facility. County file number D010021D, Supervisorial District 1, Holly Phipps, Project Manager.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Holly Phipps. I'm the Project Manager. The applicant, Dr. Billing, is requesting a third-time extension of the development plan D010021D. This is a request to construct a 110,551 square foot, 192-bed facility. The facility will provide four types of care: assisted living, skilled nursing, subacute, and Alzheimer's. The project site is located in Templeton on Los Tablas Road, directly across from Twin Cities Hospital, approximately half a mile west of Highway 101. The project site is in the office professional land use category and is located in the Salinas River planning area. Here is an aerial view of the project site. And here is the site plan for the project site. A little case history. The Board of Supervisors approved Billings development plan on December 13, 2001. The first two extensions were approved by the planning director, which extends the project to December 13, 2005. The request for a third and final extension was filed on July 16, 2005. For reason beyond the applicant's control, the required financing has not been completed. Dr. Billing, in the past year, has worked on finishing the paperwork and is awaiting financing through Love Funding Corporation with a HUD loan guarantee. All parties involved are meeting on January 19, 2006 to submit a formal HUD application. This past year, Dr. Billing has purchased the land. He's obtained a will serve letter and for water and sewer. He's obtained approval from the Army Corps of Engineers for work on a drainage ditch. Dr. Billing anticipates the final contract for submittal on June 2006. Staff feels the original permit findings can still be made. Public benefit: it can provide medical needs not currently supplied. Staff recommends approval for a third-time extension for Billing Development Plan D010021D. That concludes my staff presentation. Thank you for your time, and if there's any questions.
Questions for staff, and I'll lead off. There was an approved residential project to the rear of this that was a mixed-use project, and so I would see maybe this is could be considered a change. And I know we dealt with that, like we put, and maybe Chuck or somebody could refresh me. We required, because the residential component had to be secondary to the commercial project, we did something, we made a condition on development, or we added something to the map, or how did we ensure that this, in fact, would be a mixed-use project? I know this was going to be the commercial component of it.
Karen Nall with planning staff can
put something on the deed for Mr. Billig's project that he couldn't come back some later day and, in fact, put anything other than a commercial project.
That is correct.
Okay, and how did we do that?
Karen Nall can read that condition, sorry. Prior to recordation of the tract map, the project on the front parcel shall be required to enter into an agreement stating that the non-residential development on this site be larger than the residential component.
Okay.
So that they couldn't come back on this front parcel and build less.
The Charlie project.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or less commercial.
Thank you.
Oh, question for staff. You referenced the Army Corps had approved work on a drainage ditch. The staff report references a tributary to Toad Creek, which qualifies as a blue line stream. Are there two different wetland issues here? Do we have a drainage ditch and a tributary, or are you referring to the tributary as a drainage ditch?
Referring to the tributary as the drainage ditch.
Okay. Well, I would just suggest that tributaries to blue line streams deserve a little bit more respect and should be characterized as the valuable assets that they are. Is there?
I could interrupt you. Just to the north, it is in fact a culverted thing. It's not a pristine wetland kind of a thing.
Correct. I noted that as well. But if it is indeed still functioning as a natural as part of a natural waterway. I'm just a little troubled at the idea of relocating a creek bed. Is there no way? I mean, looking at the aerial of the site, it seems as though the project could have been configured to respect the existing boundaries of that wetland. And I'm just a little concerned about giving a third time extension to this when we do in fact have the opportunity to perhaps condition it in such a way to preserve the existing contours of that creek.
Go back and reevaluate the project from the start. So may give Holly and I a little time to read through the negative declaration. I don't know if Chuck wants to assist us with that.
Maybe Mr. Chairman, you could see if there's consensus for us to have staff do that.
I myself was satisfied. I've been involved with this project since I was on the Templeton Area Advisory Group back in the middle 80s when Mr. Billig first conceived the idea of a project back there. And I remember at one time we had one of the members of the advisory group said she used to plow that area. And it was some anecdotal evidence of what went on there when she farmed that area. And I know we had some discussions that it was fitting and proper to do some movements. And the Fish and Game, who I consider the 300-pound elephant in the room, approved it, so I'm through. Well, that satisfies me. If Fish and Game was okay with it, it's okay with me.
I would agree.
Yeah. And beyond that, there's a letter on 411 from the Army Corps, which indicates that he has a permit to do that at this point.
Well, and it's true, but Army Corps hasn't been a stellar steward of our nation's wetland resources. And so with the acknowledgement that wetlands have been disturbed in this county and beyond through a variety of insults, acknowledging that it's not a pristine waterway. That's just my concern is that the project wasn't cited as sensitively as it could have been, and we may at this juncture have the opportunity to rectify that oversight. But I'm sensing that I'm not in the majority on the commission, and so
Commissioner Christie, if I may add, originally from past agricultural activities, much of the Blue Line Creek has been disturbed by these patch agricultural activities. And reading from here, the remaining oaks and viable riparian habitat are mostly on the portion of the creek. The creek still remains in the Department of Fish and Game's criteria for stream habitat. The medical facility calls for relocating the disturbed portion of the creek southward towards the lot line. And the creek could be made an attractive amenity for passive use. For the area. Right now it's
Mr. Chairman, this is a time extension. Maybe we could just sort of try and focus on the application that's before us. I think it would be helpful.
Well, we'll get all the issues out here.
Time extensions can include revisions, just for the record. Third time extensions.
We, in reviewing projects, as I'm believe the Army Corps of Engineers discovered this, and technically this is a blue line stream. So that all our negotiations and discussions with the Army Corps of Engineers, which took a long time, I mean a long time, and predicated everything was, and we are doing wetlands restoration as part of our agreement. It's a very complicated agreement we have with the Army Corps of Engineers. To revisit that would be an absolute disaster to this project. It would take, drag it on for a year. They've made, it's been addressed by everybody. Like has been mentioned, it's been approved by Fish and Game, approved by every agency. We've had archaeological surveys. I mean, this is, you know, this project is essentially, after going through all that, has not changed at all. We are not doing anything differently on this project. Now, I would like to say that this is supported by everybody. There's letters of support from the Medical Society, from Tenet Healthcare, from multiple doctors, neurosurgeons. We are going to be able to rehabilitate people who presently are shipped out of the county or get very inferior care at the present time. This is a highly needed project that's supported virtually by everybody, and I think, like the staff will attest to, nobody's ever complained about this project, et cetera. In fact, there's been nothing but an emphasis of people wanting to have the project. And the hospital desperately needs it, because I think you're aware that Twin Cities is undergoing an expansion, but the reality of the situation is that the expansion is not big enough to handle all their needs. And what we will do is allow for patients to leave the hospital sooner, i.e. stroke patients, people with multiple joint replacements, people with spinal surgery, et cetera. And then that will free up beds for the next patient, because when come the next flu epidemic, and hopefully it's not an avian flu epidemic, the hospital is impacted, because a lot of the expansion in Twin Cities Hospital here is intensive care beds. It's things that are really needed, a whole new OB section, a expanded emergency room. But it does not really provide that many more beds, and it's certainly, with a growing area, the need is there. Now, I think everybody's been supportive of, like I said, of all the adjacent property owners. We've not had any complaints, and I think we've satisfied all the agencies. So hopefully you give us a positive outlook, and maybe I'd like to invite my architect, Charlie Englehart, from Virginia, who's a healthcare architect, to explain a little bit and answer maybe any questions. Do you have any questions of me now? Maybe that's it.
Dr. Billig, I wonder if you could just very briefly outline for the commission the nature of the restoration and mitigation activities. I know the staff report said that it wouldn't be appropriate to do those on site, and so if you could just briefly outline for us what kind of mitigation activities you have agreed to.
Well, I don't have the document, or maybe let's have Charlie address that.
The staff has the document.
You got to be on the microphone and give your name, sir. You could get either one. Mr. Billig, you can stay there if you wanted to.
My name is Charlie Englehart. I'm the architect for the project. The Army Corps of Engineers requirements are, I submitted them with the letter from the Army Corps of Engineers. And for your information, we're only straightening out 110 feet of the ditch, and it's really a ditch.
Can you just briefly outline what those mitigation measures are, sir?
No, I can't. It's all written down there in the Army Corps requirements, and we are hiring a specialist in the mitigation to submit the plans to the Corps for their approval. Do you have the Army Corps letter there? I know I sent it.
They're shuffling.
It should be in your package.
411.
The
Army Corps letter that I have talks about the type of activities that are to take place regarding the permit for relocating the stream bed.
Right.
But I understand mitigation to be something separate and distinct from that.
Well, we have to provide various types of planting. And I'm not totally up on it, because we haven't started working on getting that part through the Army Corps.
Here's that we only have the first page of the Army Corps letter, and whether there are mitigation measures spelled out subsequent, we don't know for sure.
That could be the problem.
Well, this plan was, I'm trying to remember what the size of the acreage is. We are going to go in and under there with an approved plan for them. So we have the permit. We have the area we have to, they've designated the amount of area. We have not submitted the plan actually from the landscape architect at this time.
Right.
We can't go in and do the work till after April 15th. So, you know, in a process of doing things, but this is certainly conditional. Nothing's going to happen without the Army Corps of Engineers being satisfied. And there's it's complicated because there was a trail, and there's a whole lot of things. But I wish we had all the exact details for you, but believe me, it's to everybody's satisfaction that's involved here, the ship fishing. The limit at $20 million. They changed the policy nationally. We had basically, through the help of Bill Thomas's office and through everything, had everything going, and through the state director of the USDA Rural Development, and we were ready to go. We had discussion with Washington, D.C. We had the lender set up, and so we had to then re-explore our funding. Now, we have several backup fundings, but of recent times, the last several months, we've had discussions with HUD in Los Angeles, sit-down meetings with HUD in Los Angeles, and there's probably a 90 to 95% chance we're going to have HUD financing. Now, that would be preferable, because what they do is they give you 90% financing and 40-year amortization. So for the mechanics of the project, that's ideal. But we are also dealing with the Marshall Group, which has a letter of intent. Marshall Group's a consortium of banks headquartered in Birmingham, Alabama. But we were really delayed because it took several years to go through all the requirements of feasibility studies and everything to satisfy USDA Rural Development. The problem was the cost of the project exceeded what they arbitrarily decided was a limit for political reasons or whatever on a national level. So that was the reason for the delay in financing.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the applicants? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a public hearing. Is anyone from the public wishes to speak on this matter? I see you have no speaker slips. Seeing none, unless Mr. Billig has any concluding remarks, I'll close the public hearing, bring it back to the commission for further discussion, action.
Mr. Chairman, I would move approval of the third time extension for the Billig Development Plan D010021D.
Motion.
Second.
Got a second. Discussion. Roll call.
Commissioner Rappa?
Yes.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Chairman Rose?
Yes. That concludes that. Could we go to our last item of the day?
Continued hearing to consider a request by Westpac Investments for a vesting tentative tract map, tract 2659, and conditional use permit. The site is in the Salinas River Planning Area, County File Number SUB2004-00001, Supervisorial District 1, Josh LeBombard, Warren Hogue. Speaking for Josh LeBombard.
Thank you, Ramona. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll pinch in for Josh on this one. Chairman Rose is familiar with this project. For the benefit of the rest of the commission, it's a large mixed-use project on Theater Drive Ramada Drive in Templeton. And there's been a great deal of community concern, and when the mitigated negative declaration was circulated for this project, there was a request for a review that raised substantive concerns, and we are working with the applicant to provide us with additional information to address those concerns. It's possible that that additional information could continue to justify a mitigated negative declaration. It's also possible that additional information may lead staff to recommend an EIR on the project. We won't know until we receive that additional information. Because we're working with the applicants on this, but we don't know when exactly we'll get that information or the conclusion that we'll reach, we're requesting that this hearing be continued off calendar. When it's ready to come back to your commission, either with a negative declaration or with an EIR, we'll re-advertise the project, and we'll continue to have communications and dialogue with the community as well.
Okay, one thing that
I learned that the conference was about a state law, I think it's SB 220, in combination with another one, which I think was 610. It's the one related to if you're going to approve a residential development of 500 units or greater. And we got into this with the Woodlands, but there's also a, for smaller projects, if you exceed 10% of the water connections for the local water utility, which in this case would be the Templeton Community Services District, and just from what I've heard, this may be on the cusp of that. And so as you go through your further considerations, you might look at that and see whether that, in fact, does apply or not. Just want to bring it up today rather than...
This is the time to do it. Thank you for bringing that up to us. We'll look into that.
Okay. Mr. Marshall, would you raise your tie? It's the Christmas season.
If I might answer Mrs. Rapp's question, because I'm sure that the listening audience may want to know the answer. It's been custom for the commission not to hold its second meeting in December because it occurs in Christmas week. And we were able to do an additional meeting or to schedule a second meeting in November the week after Thanksgiving that was otherwise the same date as Thanksgiving. And with that meeting, November 30th, today's meeting, and the January 12th meeting, we're able to handle the flow of business. So we assumed that the custom was acceptable to your commission, although we didn't directly ask you if you wanted to have a meeting.
Believe me, it is. It is.
I will tell you that if we do have a meeting on the 22nd, we don't have time to notice anything.
Okay, we're not.
I only refer to it because I got my calendar a long time ago online, and so we are advertising to people or indicating to people that we will have a meeting on that day. I have zero interest in coming on the 22nd.
You bring up another very good point, and that's that we need to make sure that what we have available to the public online is accurate.
Thank you. And for us sillies who just...
Yeah. And with that final discussion, we are adjourned. Please note the time.
Oh, I don't know. I pushed the wrong button.